thought about God's incredible kindness? I mean, there are events in my life that I would never have chosen, but in God's wisdom and in his kindness, he patiently went before me into some deep waters. Most of you have heard the story of how New City was birthed. If you haven't, I would love to share it with you. But this is not that. This is the messy and broken prequel to that story. My wife and I knew that we were called to plant this church through a variety of different people who affirmed it in a variety of ways. And in God's kindness, we did not know how painful it would be, the pruning process leading up to planting a church would be, in order to humble us enough to plant a church. And if I'm honest, I would have to acknowledge that if I had known ahead of time what we would have to go through, I would not have willingly gone through it. Ignorance wasn't bliss, but in my case, because of my weak faith, it was necessary. When we first began to share with our extended family that God was calling us to plant a church, we found it odd that they would always ask the same question. They'd look at us like we were crazy, and they would always ask the question, how are you going to feed your children? How are you going to get a paycheck? Do you have any money saved up for this? Do you even have a group of people to plant a church with? I don't know, but God told us to do it, and so we're going to do it. I was around this time, during this process, that my position at the company I worked for was eliminated. We were convinced that this was God's first step in planting this new church. We were convinced that if God took away one job, not only was he going to give me another job, he would give me a greater job with a far greater income and a far greater freedom in order to do other things, and life would be far greater than we ever imagined. I mean, that's why tragedy comes, right? Difficulties come because God is planning to do something even better. That's what we say to each other. By the way, it's called church planting because of all the manure you have to deal with along the way, including discovering that you yourself actually believe a form of the prosperity gospel. Well, by the time we launched nearly 10 years later, we had almost lost our home. We had had our phone disconnected for lack of payment. It was the old style. It had a cord. It was a blessing in disguise because that meant the creditors couldn't call us bad names on the phone. We thought our reputation had been ruined, and most importantly, what we discovered in this difficult financial struggle we were in all those years ago was that God had humbled both of us by tearing down our idols and our pride and our self-righteousness. He is so very kind. We were unaware of the danger we would be in because of our obedience to his call, and this ignorance was a blessing. See, even though our circumstances at the time were painful, God was deconstructing our identities. As we struggled financially, we came to think of ourselves as financial bums who couldn't meet their financial obligations. Our identity had become those people who are unable to pay their bills. But God showed us that our self-made identities were tied to this world, and he showed us a better one from his world. Understanding that we have nothing to offer in and of ourselves other than a faith based entirely on his character has been invaluable in this work that he has called us to do. You see, truly living by faith deconstructs our false beliefs about identities. Right? As parents, we think, if I'm a good parent, my kids will turn out okay. But then there's the flip side of it, which is my kids didn't turn out okay, therefore I must be a terrible parent. Or as an employee, we think that our value has everything to do with our production or our ability to add value to the company or our ability to get promoted or our ability to not get downsized or find another job. As individuals, we think that our value as followers of Christ is directly tied to our ability to obey all the rules or avoid sins. Well, at least the really bad ones. Or we have false beliefs about our identity, as my wife and I had, that if we faithfully follow the Lord, we shouldn't struggle in the ways we struggled. Living living by faith deconstructs these false identities and helps us root our faith in the only one who is worthy to be trusted at all times. Whether that faith leads us down a very difficult path or it leads us into the promised land. Living by faith is always the right choice. We're in Joshua chapter 3 this morning. Beginning with verse 1. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, "As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." Then Joshua said to the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." And Joshua said to the priests, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. The Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant. When you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan." And Joshua said to the people of Israel, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand up in one heap." So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan. And those flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. The events of chapter 3 happened immediately after the events of chapters 1 and 2. I know that sounds kind of obvious, but it's important that we see the direct connection. In chapter 1, Joshua told the people that they needed to prepare provisions. That is, in their case, that meant food for the journey. They were getting up, and they were ready to travel into the land. They were camped at a place called Shittim. It's about 7 miles due east of the point at which they would cross into Jericho. Jericho is another 7 miles due west. So they're about 14 miles from the city of Jericho with the river in between. Now, it's important because God had led the people to Shittim, right? It is opposite Jericho. Jericho is the first city to be subdued in the land of Canaan because it was the fort that guarded the three major roads into the land. When the spies returned from Jericho and spoke to Joshua, they declared that God had given them the land. This means Jericho would be the first place the people of Israel laid claim to the land of Canaan. Chapter 2 ends with the spies giving their report to Joshua, and chapter 3 begins the following morning. So Joshua and all Israel, they broke camp at Shittim. They left Shittim. They arrived at the river later that day, perhaps even that morning. They had just traveled 7 miles. That's it. They could easily travel 7 miles with all their stuff. Now remember, when they left Egypt 40-some years earlier, they had a whole lot of stuff. They had lots of animals, livestock, and herds. They had all kinds of animals. They had gold and jewels. They were given clothing by the Egyptians. They would have had wagons to carry all their stuff. This is not a fast-moving group of people. Plus, they also had little children, and yet they could easily travel 7 miles in a day with all that. And yet, when they arrived later that day, God has them stay put for 3 more days. After 3 days, though, the leaders go throughout the people and they give them instructions. When you see the Ark of the Covenant being carried by the priests, quickly break camp, pack up your tents, put everything in your wagons, and follow the priests across the Jordan. But notice in verse 4, the specific instruction. They must remain at least 2,000 cubits from the Ark. It's about half a mile, but 1,000 yards-ish, 10 football fields. The people are told to keep their distance. Right? They cannot come closer to the ark than that. And notice the reason in verse 4. He said it's so that they may know the way they shall go, because none of them had been that way before. They didn't know where they were going, so they had to follow the ark. So on a practical level, if people got too close to the ark in a crowd that size, people further back would lose sight of the ark. But also on that same practical level, I can't imagine 2 million people just running around in circles. And, I mean, how hard is it to follow the person in front of you? I mean, don't tell my kindergarten teacher that I said that, because, you know. I mean, is there really a risk that someone would get lost? Well, probably not, but what's the real reason they had to keep sight of the ark? I mean, an ark is simply a box. That's what the word means. In this case, it was the box that God had instructed Moses to have built. It had rings on it, so there were poles that the priests would put through whenever they needed to carry it. They couldn't touch it. They had to carry it on the poles. Inside the ark were the tablets of the covenant, right? The Ten Commandments were written on them. That was God's covenant with Israel. There was a jar of manna stored inside, and also Aaron's rod, a symbol of his priestly authority. The ark was covered in gold. It had a lid on top. The lid had two gold cherubim on them. Now, you got to understand that cherubim are not cherubs, fat little babies with wings. I mean, I don't know why that's the popular imagination of cherubs, but cherubim are frightening angelic creatures. Right? It was cherubim that God gave the task of guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden, and they carried flaming swords. Anyone seeing these creatures would have been frightened, not want to pinch cheeks. They weren't fat little babies. They were frightening. In fact, Hezekiah described God's throne when he prayed in 2 Kings 19. Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim. He connects the cherubim to God's authority. So in his instructions to Moses about the ark, God told him that he would come down and he would sit between the cherubim on top of the ark in order to speak with Moses. So the Ark of the Covenant was the visible symbol of God's throne. One author said that it's the visible throne of the invisible God. The reason the Israelites must not crowd around the ark is so that all the Israelites might see the ark from a distance and know that God is their king, God is their Lord. And even as they must follow and submit to Joshua's leadership, the reality is Joshua is not in charge, God is. It is God that they are following into the land. Now, he says they're about to see the God of Israel do something amazing in their midst. He tells them in verse 5 that they have to consecrate themselves. They have to set themselves apart. They have to be ritually pure. They cannot make themselves ritually unclean. And the reason given is that the following day, the Lord is going to do wonders among them. Remember, they're about to enter the promised land for the very first time. Now, a couple of them had been in the land, right? The bumbling spies who went to Jericho and back and didn't do a whole lot of spying. The people had never been there. None of them had ever been in the promised land. But the promise had been made many, many centuries before to Abraham that Abraham's descendants would inherit the land, but then his descendants spent several centuries as slaves in Egypt. But now they're at the banks of the Jordan. As soon as they cross the river, they are in the land God promised to give to Abraham. They will see the Lord do wonders the following day, so they must be prepared for it. And then in verse 6, this is now the next day, Joshua instructs the priest to carry the ark, to pass through all the people of Israel. They were camped. The camp would have been quite large to accommodate a couple million people. And so it would take quite some time for the priest to pass through the entire camp. So that gave them time to pack up their tents quickly, to put all their stuff in a wagon, to find where the kids are, and follow behind the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 7, God tells Joshua, he's about to exalt him in the sight of Israel, just as he had been with Moses, so now God was going to be with Joshua. And then he gives Joshua some instructions for entering the land. But look at verse 8 again. It says, as for you, Joshua, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. That sounds like a simple enough instruction, right? Just, all right, you got this big heavy ark on your shoulders, but there's several priests carrying it, right? Just wade into the middle of the stream and stand there. Well, you might remember back in chapter 2 when the spies were at Rahab's house and she hid them in stalks of flax on her roof. The flax was up there because it was drying, because the flax had just been harvested. But flax is a winter crop. It's warm in Israel, warm enough to grow crops during the winter season. It's actually the rainy season. So that was the perfect time to grow a lot of the crops. Which means that winter season is now over. It's harvest season, which means it's the beginning of spring. And so all the snow on the mountains to the north is melting and feeding into the creeks and streams and rivers that feed into the Jordan River. What does the narrator say in verse 16? Now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the harvest. Now at this place, the Jordan is normally 90, it's a lot smaller today because it's dried out quite a bit. But in that day, it was normally 90 to 100 feet wide. That's a pretty good sized river. When it overflowed its banks, however, it could be as wide as a half mile. So when God tells Joshua to have the priests carry the ark, remember it's made of wood and it's covered in gold, and gold is very heavy, he tells them to stand still in the middle of the river, he's telling them to walk into a raging river that is well over their heads. Stand still in that river. It's not like they're carrying a large flotation device. You understand what's happening here. They have on their shoulders a very heavy box made of gold, and that box was heavy, and therefore they would sink immediately, causing them to sink to the bottom. So not only does he tell them to walk into the raging waters, he tells them then to stand still in the water. Something else we need to know here. In verse 16, the narrator mentions the city of Adam. City of Adam is the one, near Zarethan. You were wondering which Adam we're talking about. It's the one by Zarethan. It's about 17 miles to the north of where they're crossing. It is at Adam that crossing the Jordan River becomes treacherous. That is, everything south of Adam becomes treacherous. Israel is camped south of Adam. Now, to be fair, they are at the fords across the Jordan. It's a shallower portion. There would have been lots of rocks back in chapter 2, right? The king's men chased the spies to the fords of the Jordan. If they couldn't catch them by then, there was no way they're going to catch them across the river. That was the crossing point, but now you have to add several feet of water on top of what normally would be there, because it was the time the Jordan overflows its banks. And those rocks that used to be stepping stones across are now creating white water. That's how white water is created. Turbulence. So think of this. They're camped at a place called Shittim. They're told to break camp, travel 7 miles, and then set up camp again for 3 days. And from there, where they're camped on the banks of the Jordan, this is the thing. They could have traveled the 17 miles north to Adam, cross over at the much calmer portion of the river, and then travel the 17 miles back to be at the very opposite side of the river where they were. All in the time that they spent camping there. It wouldn't have cost them any more time. It would have taken about 3 days to go those 35 miles. So why does God have them travel the relatively short distance to the river at one of the worst possible places to cross and then stay there 3 days when they could have found a safer place to cross just a few miles north? The simple answer is God often leads us to deeper waters than we can walk through. And then he tells us to wait there. In verse 10, Joshua spoke to the people of Israel. He says that they will know the way. This is how they will know that the living God among them is this. He will, without fail, drive out the people of the land before them. That's a profound statement. You will know the living God is among you when he does something you cannot do. The evidence that God is at work is that God does the impossible around you and in your life. Now remember, there are only two things that God tells Joshua. He says, Joshua, that the priest must stand still in the Jordan, and he tells Joshua that he'll make him like Moses, that he will exalt him, and just as he was with Moses, he's going to be with Joshua. There are no other details recorded. Joshua takes God at his word, and he tells the people in verse 13 that when the soles of the feet of the priest carrying the ark step into the waters of the Jordan is going to stop flowing. Now, where would he get such an idea? Again, the narrator doesn't record God saying this to Joshua. Joshua seems to have figured this out on his own. God says he will make Joshua like Moses, and he tells the priest to stand still in the river. But here's the thing. God knows they can't stand still in the river. But Joshua also remembers the time when God used Moses to part some water so that all Israel could walk through it. If he's going to make him like Moses, then perhaps God is going to do the same with this here river. Just as Israel left Egypt walking through water that God parted, so they will enter the promised land walking through water that God parted. In verse 14, we read that when the people had broken camp and followed the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant, remember, the visible throne of the invisible God, and when the feet of the priest stepped into the water, it stopped flowing. But notice it says, when their feet were dipped in the brink of the water, right? And it says that the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. The people, including the priests, had never been this way before. They did not know the normal banks of the Jordan River, so they don't know how much the Jordan is overflowed. I mean, you've never been to the Grand River, and it's in flood stage. How do you know what the actual riverbank is? You've never been that way before. They didn't know where the drop-off from the normal banks were. They didn't know how far from the brink of the water, the edge of the water, the actual riverbed was. But the thing is, when a river overflows, the new edges of the water tend to be much shallower and slope down much less steeply than the actual banks of the river. All the people had to do was walk forward in faith. That's all they had to do. As soon as they demonstrated their faith in God who had gotten them this far, God did what only he could do, and he stopped the water from flowing. But notice in verse 16 that the water piled up very far away, that is all the way up at Adam, the city, you know, the one beside Zarethan. Isn't that interesting? The place that would have been far safer to cross the Jordan is now covered in even more water. And the place that would have been more dangerous is now made completely safe. Crossing the Jordan at this place, though it appeared to be a raging maelstrom of churning white water, was far safer than the more gently flowing section north of Adam. So listen to this. It is always safer to follow God in faith than it is to pursue the seemingly safer alternative on our own. It's safer even when it appears to be more dangerous. Though the people could only see the flood zone and could only imagine the dangers lurking beneath the surface, God knew all along what he was about to do. Back in verse 11, Joshua told them that the Lord of all the earth was passing over before them into the Jordan. In verse 13, he says, when the soles of the feet of the priest step into the water, their feet shall rest in the water. Calmly, sure-footed, in no danger of slipping. You know, one of my favorite passages in all of Scripture is what John saw in Revelation 4. He saw an image of God sitting on his throne, and in front of his throne, he said, he saw a sea of glass, as it were, like crystal, absolutely perfectly smooth. In the ancient Near Eastern mind, the sea was a dangerous thing. It was chaotic. It was unknown. It was dangerous. Right? Sure, they had some boats, but even on the tiny little lake of Galilee, those boats weren't all that great. Let alone the actual sea. It was a dangerous place. It was a swirling maelstrom of death. However, before God's throne, all the chaos of this world, all the dangers lurking beneath the surface are nothing. They are smooth as glass as far as the eye can see. When the priests, by faith, stepped into the waters of the Jordan, the Lord of all the earth was causing their feet to rest calmly in the water. Man, the priests are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, the visible throne of the invisible God. Wherever the Lord God leads them, they can safely follow, no matter how big and how frightening the waves. Ark of the Covenant is the symbol of his power, of God's promises, of his presence among them. It is the visible proclamation of his presence with them and his control over every situation they will face, every obstacle that comes their way. So while the storms may rage around his people, the obstacles in their path may be insurmountable, too great for them, from God's perspective, that river was as smooth as glass. And when the priest stepped into the river, or more accurately, when the Lord of all the earth stepped into the river, the waters dried up from Adam in the north all the way to the Dead Sea to the south. So Israel walked through the former floodplain, down the steep bank at the river's actual edge, across the dry riverbed, up the other bank, and past the former floodplain once again. And then he says that the priests who were bearing the Ark of the Covenant stood still in the Jordan, just as God instructed them, until all the people passed into the promised land. A couple weeks ago, I pointed out that a few years earlier, when Moses was still alive, the Israelites had sinned against God at Shittim. They were fooling around with the Moabites, engaging in immorality. They were worshiping the gods of the Moabites. And for this reason, 24,000 Israelites lost their lives. They did not enter the land. When our text states in verse 1 that Israel set out from Shittim, they're doing more than just leaving the place they had been camping for some time. They were leaving behind their apostasy, their unbelief. God was calling them to cross over the Jordan into their new life, to leave behind their failures and to press on. As I explained last week, the conquest of Canaan was not about a violent military conquest, and our text this morning actually confirms this. When Joshua instructs the priest to carry the Ark of the Covenant, this was signaling that crossing the river was a spiritual exercise. It was spiritually significant. As one author put it, it was more of a religious ritual than it was a military invasion. In fact, as Yahweh, God of Israel and Lord of all the earth, was moving his people into his land in order to give it to them. This is the reason Israel must consecrate themselves. Crossing over the Jordan was an act of obedient faith and worship. They were about to do what God was telling them to do, but part of what he was telling them to do was leave old stuff behind. You're not that anymore. You're new as you enter the land. In fact, while God's power and presence would be focused on what took place within the borders of Israel, he remained Lord of all the earth. The truth is, God is demonstrating that his sovereignty here extends everywhere, that the whole world belongs to him. He is no mere tribal deity whose power is limited in any way to a particular local geography. As Rahab confessed, he is God in heavens above and on earth beneath. That means everywhere. There is no place he is not sovereign. Even when the people of the land or Israel itself sins, God remains in control even as his people rebel against him and refuse to do his will. You see, the raging river was far more powerful than any of the priests. Yet God caused their feet to rest calmly in the waters of the Jordan, and the Jordan stopped flowing. Listen, creation obeys its creator. If God wants his river to pile up like snow somewhere upriver, it's going to pile up higher and higher. I know the laws of gravity normally require water to flow downhill and fill up the lowest places. Yet God, if God wants his water to obey a new temporary law of gravity, it's going to do that, and it's going to pile up pretty high up in Adam, you know, the one near Zarephath. This means that when God tells the priests to stand still in the water, the only thing they need to be concerned about is standing still in the water. That's it. They don't need any other information. Yes, the water was torrential. Yes, it was a swirling mass of white water and very dangerous. Yes, the river was well past its banks. But remember that when God spoke the words, "Let there be light," the power of his command caused a thing that didn't even exist to obey him. If a non-existent thing is compelled to obey the voice of the Lord of all the earth, then surely the priest can step into the water. This means you and I can face whatever danger lies in our path, even if it's a path we've never walked down before. Back in verse 4, the people were instructed to keep that half-mile distance from the Ark of the Covenant. This would enable all Israel to keep their eyes on the Ark. Do you remember why that's important? They were told, don't come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go because you've never been here before. The people of Israel had never been in Canaan. Their ancestors had hundreds of years earlier, but none of them knew the land, including the two spies, because apparently they didn't actually do any spying. And you see the implicit promise in this instruction. The people were to avoid crowding around the Ark of the Covenant because none of them knew the way, and by staying back, everyone in Israel could keep his or her eyes on the Ark. This is important because of the implicit promise that God knows the way. Follow the Ark because I know where I'm going. And you got to follow. Remember, he's the Lord of all the earth. They hadn't been there before, but he has. They didn't know what lay across the river, but he knows. They didn't know just how strong the people of the land were, but he does. They don't know how deep the river is or how strong the current is, but I promise you he does because he's the one who pushed it back. They don't know what dangers lie in wait for them, but he's the Lord of all the earth. He knows everything, and if he tells the priest to simply stand still in the water, he knows exactly what he's about to do. All they need to do is trust him. But this means that they must keep their eyes on the ark, the visible throne of the invisible God. Not one of us here can know with certainty what our next step is because we cannot know what life will bring us. That's why the Apostle James actually has a really good word for us. Right? Instead of declaring what we will or won't do this time next year, he says this. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. Because none of us knows the future. The reality for us is that none of us has ever been this way before. You've never experienced tomorrow before. You're always stuck in today. Many of us stuck in yesterday, too. Can't leave the past behind. But that also means you've never been to next week. We talk about next year. You've never been to next year. You've never been that way before. Because as soon as the future becomes the present, it's no longer the future. It is now the present and immediately the past. We haven't been in the future before. The future always remains future to us. And therefore, it can be a surprise to us. And it's a surprise that we often find ourselves ill-prepared to handle. There is one. There is one who has been there before because he's the only one who's outside of time. And so he's the eternal I am. You know, God's the only one who ever fully, truly exists in the present. The moment you conceive of something as present, it's immediately past. You cannot live in that very moment, in that instant. But God is outside of time. It's all laid out before him. He's been there before. That means we have Jesus, the Ark of the New Covenant. He is the one who has gone before us. He knows the way. He has been through the temptations and trials that we face. He knows our struggles and our pain. We see this in the garden before he was crucified. He stared down what was coming at him, and he knew full well what it entailed. We face trouble without knowing how bad it will be, but he faced trouble knowing every excruciating detail. And he stayed faithful in the midst of it. Surely he can get us across the river. Many of us face a similar obstacle. Some have forgotten God's promise that he will enter into the danger ahead of us. That is, he will go before us. He will lead us. That means you and I, we must not allow the things of this world to block our view of Jesus. We have to keep everything in this world 2,000 cubits back, right? We need that space so we can see Jesus. We must not allow people in our lives or our circumstances to block our view of Jesus. What anchors us to the ground in the midst of the river is Jesus. Our faith in Jesus is what enables us to stand still on the Jordan. So if you're standing there at the water's edge and the Lord is calling you to step in the water, you can, but only if you'll keep your eyes on Jesus. See, we all face this river that is life. The water might be parenting, or it might be fighting sin, or it might be waiting for the test results from the doctor, or the need for a job, or the need for a better job. Whether you're struggling with the desire to give into your sexual temptations, or give into your anger, or give into your laziness, or give into your gossip, whatever it is, give into your pride, you need to recognize that the task is too big for you. You can't face that temptation on your own and hope to win. The difficulty you're facing is simply too strong for you. The hardship headed your way, whatever it may be, is too overwhelming for you. There's only one way you can stand still in the Jordan. there is only one way, one source of hope for you and for me. Only by looking to Jesus can any of us stand still in the water. This is because Jesus is the solid ground. This is why the Apostle Paul told the Corinthians that all the promises of God, every last one of them, find their yes in Jesus. In the midst of whatever comes our way, we must look to Jesus. We must keep our eyes fixed on him. That means we must leave behind Shittim. That is the place of our failures, the place of our apostasy, the place of our unbelief. We must step forward into whatever God places in our path in obedient faith. So when you're standing at the water's edge, you are faced with a very simple choice. You can either get your feet wet, or God's going to dry up the river for you. You can either charge headlong into the danger in front of you, or he can remove the danger altogether. There is no other choice. There is no option to stand still. There is no option to turn around and go another way. You either move forward and get wet, or you move forward and he moves the obstacle. Either way, you and I must move forward. Scotty Smith tweeted something very interesting just this morning. He said, "We exult in and exalt a Jesus who isn't maybe, could be, might be, but the one who's the bold, bodacious yes to every promise God has made. Promises we don't claim." I love this. "Promises that claim us and all of history. We can trust the God who claims us as his own. We have no other option but to trust the Lord of all the earth." That's the way forward.